You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, welcome to Heritage Radio Network On Tour. I'm Lisa Held, and today we're broadcasting live from the Young Farmers Conference at Stone Barns. We want to thank the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts and the Stone Barns Center for Food and Agriculture for making our coverage possible. So, first guests of the day. This is exciting. I'm here with Connor Stedman from Terra Genesis International and Christine Sue from Pasture Map. Thank you for being here, both of you.
Happy to be here.
Sure thing.
We were talking a little bit before, and we've already talked about glaciers and regenerative dumplings so far, so this is going to be a really interesting conversation. I think that the best place to start is for you each just to talk a little bit about what you do. Christine, you want to start?
Sure. So I'm the founder and CEO of Pasture Map, which is a software company that helps regenerative farmers and ranchers with grazing planning and management. So it's a software platform that helps them plan out grazing and do so in a way that sequesters more carbon in the soil.
Great. Connor?
I work with Terra Genesis International and a few other organizations. I am a farm business planner and ecological designer and climate educator, and work on a lot of aspects of the intersection between the climate crisis and farm business viability.
So you're both working in areas where you were farming and then you recognized you had some knowledge that you could share with other farmers, right?
I'm not a farmer at all. I'm a city girl.
How did you get to?
My career was in business and in specifically helping private companies build software platforms to track metrics. And then my personal story is I had a bunch of food allergies and gut inflammation issues, which led me to look for farmers, essentially, who could make food that I could eat without getting sick. And then because I owed a big debt of gratitude to the farmers and ranchers, I went back to school and got an agriculture degree and interned at a whole bunch of farms as a farmhand, and then essentially made up my own degree in pastoral grazing systems, like traveling around different continents, New Zealand, Australia, shoveling manure.
So you did do some farming.
Yes, I studied. Yeah. Well, as a farmhand, I actually, like, after 10 years in the industry, I wouldn't call myself a farmer. Realizing that I could help because I saw every farm with stacks of paper and notebooks and like charts on the wall to manage, because regenerative grazing, planning out rotations, is really complex when it's moving land and moving animals and land and fence and water. And as a former data person, I was like, oh, okay, I can help with this. And also since we're at the Young Farmers Conference, we have a huge generational transition that's underway. And a lot of that knowledge is in farmers' heads with 40 years of experience. How do we actually get that out of their heads and digitize it so that the next generation doesn't start from scratch?
Right. Yeah. So Connor, did the work that you're doing come out of, like, were you farming first and then recognized, oh, I have some skills that I could share with other farmers?
Well, so there was farming in my family two generations ago, but it was like, you know, dirt floor, sod house, subsistence poverty farming that people left, understandably, and when they had the ability to. But I was also a lot of my parents' friends growing up were nuclear weapons disarmament activists. Wow. So I was exposed to a lot of information about the end of the world at a very young age.
Wow.
And so, you know,
you were dealing with all the stuff that a lot of us are now like, oh my God, climate crisis. You've been dealing with this feeling for
a
lot
pretty
longer.
Much. So, you know, I went in as a teenager. I started working on farms in Maryland, the place that we were talking about having in common also, in Maryland and then on the West Coast. I worked probably 5 seasons on different small diversified farms, annual and perennial. But I was also really deeply studying ecology and the stories of the different places that I was living in and traveling to. So as the thinking was developing and the practices were developing in the mid to late 2000s, you know, which have been, the practices are decades or centuries or millennia old, but the kind of modern thinking of carbon farming was coalescing in the last decade. You know, in working on that with a bunch of the people that I was working on it with, what really became clear was that working on not just the carbon farming practices themselves, but working on the business viability and the business strategy was really necessary because, you know, sort of the hard news of the current situation is that, you know, I mean, climate change is on track to devour everything we're trying to do.
Right.
And agriculture can play this significant role, although importantly, not a silver bullet role. That's very important. Idea that all we have to do is, you know, do holistic grazing worldwide, or you know, do XYZ, do biochar worldwide, and that will solve climate change. That's not backed by the science.
Right. We have to do everything.
We have to do everything, and that's what the work of Project Drawdown makes so clear. So although agriculture can play this really significant role, like can take a significant percentage of the emissions reduction and sequestration that's needed, it is currently not business effective for most farms to do that because the public sector has not effectively supported and incentivized that positive environmental externality.
Right.
And it is not even really anywhere close to doing that currently. So it requires a basket of other business strategies other than waiting for the public sector to get on board or waiting for environmental markets to kind of fully fund the transition, because transitioning to carbon farming, regenerative agriculture systems is a significant business transition. It's not just a change in production practices and generally. It's generally an actual change in business strategy. It can be a change in markets. And often it involves diversification and or intensification of production, and that can require different equipment, different skills. So it's a very place by place, because different land is unique, and very farm business by farm business question about what the best pathway is for the producers who want to work at the leading edge of the industry.
Right. This is sort of a great place for us to go, because I think it's where your work intersects too, is this place where you're trying to make carbon farming economically not just viable, but make it so that when farmers choose to adopt these practices, it's actually better for them financially, right? And that's kind of where the magic happens. So let's talk a little bit about how you're each doing that. Maybe, Christine, can you talk a little bit about data? Because I feel like there's this data gap when it comes to carbon sequestration and farming, and PastureMap is kind of looking at that, right?
It's much more complicated than it seems at first blush, right? And coming into it, I think I was maybe naively also enchanted by this idea that we can just save the world with regenerative agriculture. And then you get into going to thousands of ranches and actually getting on the ranch and looking at what the very practical things that need to happen for somebody to start doing regenerative grazing in their context depends on what kind of soils they have, how big are those pastures, can they feasibly do temporary fence on a 40,000 acre ranch that has canyons in it. And so it's very context dependent for each of the ranch, and I'll speak to ranching because that's what I know.
Right.
What are you trying to accomplish that is appropriate for the context? What kinds of species of plants, what kinds of species of animals are you trying to bring back? And it gets really complex. And then often some of that can be grant funded, so I do want farmers and listeners to know that you actually can grant fund a lot of this through NRCS, like fence development, water development, infrastructure development is a really big part of it. And then there are certain pockets, like Colorado, there's MAD Agriculture in California. There is the Soil Carbon Coalition that can help you with business planning. Obviously, we have an expert here who can do that. So leaning on a lot of technical help. And then after almost a decade in the industry, I realized also markets is a huge part that is not addressed because, as Connor said, if you're going to try to do regenerative grazing, sometimes you may have to make a decision. Am I going to direct market my beef? How do I capture, if the funding doesn't cover everything that it requires to make these changes, I don't want to be selling commodity beef anymore, necessarily. I want to get paid for ecosystem services, and those markets are still very nascent. So your next guest is Anthony Amant, who's going to talk about ways to get other private sector players involved, like restaurants, to pay for farmers to do some of these practices. Mm. And I think, as you said before, it's going to take all of us. Like, it's yes and. We're going to have to do, the private sector's going to have to do it. From the marketing perspective, having a rancher sell into a commodity market at a fixed price that the market dictates is very different from having them take on the entire supply chain of owning that animal all the way through the supply chain and then trying to balance selling steaks and ground and whole animal. So that's actually where my work is now evolving past PastureMap is from the consumer standpoint, I think, I think it's going to be yes and. There's going to have to be grant funding for ecosystem services, and there's going to have to be there's going to have to be other players paying for the data to show that, and the data depends. It's not as simple as, oh, this farm increased soil organic matter by 1%. It's actually, did they increase the right species? Did they increase the right birds that you want? And consumers are going to have to play a big part in buying the kind of food that supports those practices.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Can I expand or add some things to that? Because So often when we think about environmental markets, the primary focus is on carbon markets, and that's appropriate because that's the primary greenhouse gas externality that is driving the climate disasters that are happening and that we're heading towards. And so ways to nudge the economy in the way it works towards a situation where polluters are paying for their greenhouse gas emissions and that money is paying for this resequestration of those same emissions by farmers, that's the kind of economic relationship that we can and need to head towards. But those aren't the only environmental markets. And also there are a number of different policy instruments that can create market conditions like that. There's an early example of that with California's cap and trade market, and with some of the funding from that going to the Healthy Soils Initiative. But I want to speak also to nutrient pollution reduction markets. So there are federally mandated pollution limits on water bodies and waterways that EPA set generally back in the 70s and 80s. And states generally were given targets that they had to hit by a certain date. They usually given 20 to 30 years to hit those targets.
Right.
And in general, the states did not hit those targets. So then there's a more punitive set of requirements that EPA brought in saying, okay, now you have to even go on an even steeper curve of pollution reduction. Otherwise, there's fines and there'll be even more punitive fines if you don't meet these next targets. And so, for instance, in the Chesapeake Bay watershed where I grew up and where some you all have connection to, the important thing to know is that was a federally driven process by EPA that led to the state of Maryland in partnership with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, among a number of other things, putting in place a 75% cost share for cover cropping in the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
Right.
And that improved cover crop adoption of over 50% for farmers in that watershed.
I think Maryland is one of the most successful cover cropping.
Yeah. And to be clear, cover cropping is a important and tiny piece of the overall carbon farming story.
I totally agree with this. To draw an example in California, I mean, people have been talking about carbon for a really long time. The Marine Carbon Project has been gathering data on carbon sequestration with compost and other things. And now we have the Healthy Soils Initiative. But I think there's a lot of opportunity for also to capture public imagination and pressure for things like wildfire, right? So wildfire is top of mind for everybody in California right now.
Of course.
And where we might actually see a lot of regenerative practices getting funding is we're working with Sonoma and Mendocino County ranchers to talk about making a region-wide grazing map of mapping where the fuel loads are, like where is there grazable land that is getting encroached with brush, and then can we actually have the state pay for farmers to and ranchers to graze for wildfire prevention,
right?
Yeah, and if I can just add another thing to that, so, and this is another linkage to data and analytics with kind of environmental planning and regenerative agriculture. So one of the projects I've worked on in the past year is with an organization in Southern California, White Buffalo Land Trust. Jesse Smith is here at the conference, and you know, and it was looking at a particular landscape in Santa Barbara County for a significant expansion of regenerative grazing. But part of what we were looking at is how can diversified ecological ranching include and integrate with and bring in, you know, research and philanthropic funding for oak regeneration and oak forest restoration, because there's a oak reproduction crisis in a lot of California, and there's a lot of climate change stressors, and some of those landscapes are really vulnerable to wildfire, and they play a big role in mitigating the effect of wildfire. So I think the important thing is that it's different in different places.
Yes.
And so there's a place-specific thought process that we were going through and are continuing to go through in that region of California. There's a different place-specific thought process in the Low Sierra, and in every place has its own unique considerations around this conversation that people really have to dig into rather than just replicating a set of best practices everywhere.
Right. So we're talking about a lot of really big ideas, policy, companies that you work with that are kind of implementing these ideas all over the country. For young farmers that are here, that are watching, that are listening and are like, yeah, carbon sequestration. I want to sequester carbon on my farm. Like, what's the advice that you give to just get started, to be involved in this kind of farming?
Build a viable business. That's the number one. I was going to say, this conversation is wide-ranging, as many people in this movement like to talk. It's quite esoteric. I like to quote AOC that when you're building a movement, everywhere you advance, the front line matters. And I think that's very much the case for regenerative agriculture. And we don't talk about the people part of it enough. We need to have a vibrant, diverse, inclusive movement of people on the land. We need to heal our communities as much as we need to heal the soil. And so the most important thing for young farmers, I think, is I get concerned about how extractive farming work is. Because like a lot of people get into to try to save the world, or even I was talking yesterday to some folks who were like, it's fine, I just want to feed my community. And that is totally okay. Like that is great and honorable, and we need vibrant community farmers. And we're not going to have those if we don't have viable businesses. So I think business planning, strategic planning, like before, it's almost like, so there are some really great multi-generational farmers here who I know are regenerative farmers, but aren't necessarily, you know, don't have the capacity to participate in all these programs, but they're doing the work. And so before you dive into all of the associations that we were just talking about, make sure that there's, like, you are producing a product that you have a market for and that they are paying you a fair price for what you're providing.
That was exactly my thought about the number one thing is do what makes sense for your business viability. And in the long run, your business viability and your land-based viability are the same.
Yes.
But in the short term, that's not always the case. And sometimes there's hard decisions that people have to make. And you know, I think the other thing I would add to that is that, you know, like right now we've talked about how the conversation is wide ranging, and I would actually suggest that what we're talking about is not abstract though. Huh. It actually is the full complexity of how the world works.
Right.
And farming is agriculture is a profession and an industry that actually requires an engagement with the full complexity of how the world works. And so it's very like. embodied hands-on machines and animals and fencing work, but it's also very intellectual work in this very applied way, because the questions, like, for instance, Soulfire Farm has been sharing this statistic recently a lot, that 80% of agricultural labor in the U.S. is Latino, and 98% of agricultural land ownership is white. So that's not abstract. That's a really concrete reality in the industry that is not accidental. That's the legacy of racism and policy. That's the legacy of a fundamentally extractive mindset towards people and towards land.
Oh, yes. Okay. I'm so glad we're on this. The extraction regeneration conversation, I think, as a community, we have to move beyond the ecological regeneration part, which we all love to nerd out about, and talk about social regeneration. And that starts with, yes, acknowledging systemic abuses, but also with fights like climate and with wildfires and things like that. Often it can be extractive to be in the, like, that itself can cause repeated trauma, right? So and farming itself is fairly traumatizing. Like, there's a lot of death in it, and there's a lot of failure through forces that are largely not controlled by you. And so I think that I would love to see our community and the folks who are listening and watching have more open conversations about mental health and emotional health and how to regenerate ourselves first, because I see a lot of farmers pouring so much of themselves into the work. And then yesterday, Nephi Craig, as a Western Apache speaker, was talking about how self-care is an act of compassion, because compassion is an act of recognizing and alleviating suffering, and often we don't recognize the suffering in ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's so critical to this work.
Yeah, and if I could just follow up on that too, I think another piece of, like, to your original question, another piece of kind of, like, core advice for beginning farmers is that I think some of what makes these conversations non-abstract is the remembering and exercising of our personal agency. So, there's so many forces in markets and capitalism and the way that the world is set up right now that strip people of their experience of personal agency and their ability to exercise it. And yet there is this kind of, one of my colleagues and teachers at the Leadership for Sustainability program at the University of Vermont that I work in, Kaylin Two Trees, talks about this idea of sovereign logic, that individuals have a sovereign logic that is unique to us, and that there's actually significant work to understand it and live it out in the world. And so I think that, like, we're in a big mess. Like, we're in a really big mess, and it's really not headed in a direction of getting cleaned up, to be honest. And yet individuals continue to have personal agency within that situation, and businesses continue to have agency within that situation, and organizations have agency. And so the inner willingness to return to and exercise that agency, even in the face of all that we're under, I think is a really crucial thing. And for beginning farmers to remember that they can do that, even when, as people say, even when the bullets are flying and the babies need to be fed, that's good. Like, that's, and because that's going to be, given that the public sector is not supporting what we're talking about right now substantially, that's going to be required every step of the way for people to keep deciding to do stuff.
Absolutely. I don't know if this is a conversation you wanted to have, but I'm loving it.
It is great. Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Oh.
Flew by. We covered a lot. But I think that's actually a great point to end on, just this idea of agency, right? Like, it can feel really overwhelming when you talk about these issues. You guys are doing amazing work and inspiring others to do the same.
I've learned a lot from justice movements, because my husband is Jewish, from racial justice movements also. Like, there are times when the world is incredibly dark, and that's when rooting down and building resilience and recognizing your agency to continue to heal is really critical.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Connor and Christine.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network On Tour. Thanks again to the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts for making our On Tour coverage possible, and to Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture for having us here for the Young Farmers Conference. I'm Lisa Held. Stay tuned for more.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.